from KQED.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. The Me Too movement has captured the nation's attention with allegations of sexual harassment and abuse of women in high-profile industries. Less attention has been paid to the sexual abuse women suffer in working-class jobs. A team of reporters from KQED and other media outlets has checked back in on its 2015 investigation, Rape on the Night Shift, about the sexual abuse of immigrant women janitors, and they found women organizing and learning how to fight back. With us in studio, Sasha Coca, host for California Report Magazine at KQED. Good morning.
Hi, Michael.
Glad to have you. And Bernice Jung, who is reporter for Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting, author of the forthcoming book, In a Day's Work, The Fight to End Sexual Violence Against America's Most Vulnerable Workers. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
And this reported, they reported the story as part of a collaboration between KQED, Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting, Frontline, Univision, and the investigative reporting program at UC Berkeley. And congratulations. It's an important program. Getting the word out here has been stunning in many ways in terms of the effect it's had, the impact it's had, and the stories, which are indeed about the most vulnerable workers, invisible workforce really is probably the best way to describe them. These people on the night shift who are isolated and who are just terrible. Vulnerable. And these are heartbreaking stories, many of them. I mean, these are women who are preyed upon. But what I was struck by, struck very poignantly by the stories, but this has taken some real outcomes. I mean, it's had some real, let's talk to you about that, Bernice.
It's been really startling. I mean, we've been seeing this whole Me Too movement emerge since last fall. But for a lot of the janitors that we covered, their kind of Me Too moment started in 2016. You know, our reporting came out, our investigation came out in 2015. And then it was amazing the way in which they became so activated. You know, the union got involved. A lot of unionized and non-unionized janitors came forward. They started pushing for legislation at the state level. They were out at marches and rallies holding up signs that said end rape on the night shift. They were just truly speaking out for the first time in a really remarkable way.
Demonstrating, fasting, getting the governor to sign a bill. Yeah, basta was a whole movement in itself. I mean, this is really remarkable what's taken place. But the stories, Sasha, again, are so heartbreaking because these women were told, nobody's going to believe you. You know, they're not going to care about this. They were threatened. There was a whole, I mean, this trajectory has moved upward. And finally, there's accountability and there's legislation. But for a while there, especially the undocumented, were so unprotected by anything.
That's right. I mean, I was particularly struck over and over again by the courage that it took these women to agree to share their stories with us, both on the radio, on television. As you say, we did it as a multi-platform project in both English and Spanish. And part of that was because we had a commitment to letting other people know about these stories who might be affected by similar dynamics. I really recall poignantly the story of one janitor in Bakersfield. Her name is Maria Magana. And, you know, she was threatened and harassed for years, groped, grabbed by her supervisor, who was a known sex offender. I mean, this guy had gone to jail for
rape. He lied on his job application because he wanted the job.
That's right.
I mean, that's it. Yeah.
And, you know, she tried to fend him off. She tried to fight him back. Let's just hear a little bit of what she told us.
So I hit him with my broom and he said, Maria, why are you so mad? What am I doing wrong? It's just a caress. I'm just being affectionate. I told him, you get any closer and I will hit you with the handle right now. I told him, I'm going to spray this cleaner in your eyes.
And, you know, finally, he ended up raping her, assaulting her at a bank that she was cleaning in Bakersfield. And, you know, it's been a very painful journey for her. I checked in with her again recently. She's been really triggered by the Me Too movement, by all these women in Hollywood coming forward, seeing this all over the news. And, you know, it's been a very difficult journey. She did file a case as part of a class action lawsuit with the federal government against her employer, ABM, one of the largest janitorial companies in the nation. And, you know, she was able to reach a settlement with them, but the money hasn't eased her pain.
She didn't care about the money. I mean,
it
was made very clear in the documentary. But the reality is that the women are fighting back, and yet these companies, they talk about their accountability and zero tolerance and all the rest of that, and it seems to fly in the face of what you have uncovered. I mean, there just wasn't the kind of monitoring that there had to be.
That's right. And in fact, you know, it continues to be a problem. We've unearthed three more cases in the Central Valley in Fresno where janitors say that they were either harassed or in one case actually raped, another attempted rape, at the same company, at ABM. And this is a company that has been taken to task three times. The federal government has sued them to make improvements in the way that they protect women from sexual harassment. They've made multiple attempts, they say, to improve their policies. They've had additional monitoring and outside investigators. Yet we're continuing to see cases where this is a problem.
And this is true also with SMS, Bernice. I mean, that's the national company that's also profiled in the documentary.
That's right. There's another company where when an allegation came forward in Minnesota, the company essentially asked the supervisor, the offending supervisor, to investigate himself. As a result of that litigation, it resulted in a settlement where they had to make some improvements to how they also address sexual harassment. We haven't found any new cases against SMS, however.
Well, it was striking when you were talking about Minneapolis because when the prosecutor said, well, I don't have evidence, you know, as he said, she said, and he said, I believe the victim, though. I mean, that's the terrible irony here. He said, but, you know, to prove beyond a reasonable doubt, I can't go forward with it. But you profile Kirsten Gillibrand here in the documentary saying the reality is survivors themselves can offer evidence. So to some extent, those who are supposedly making conforming to the law a part of what they're doing as prosecutors aren't necessarily on the same wavelength that they need to be. I thought we'd hear another cut. Before we do, though, I wanted to ask you something that you said, Sasha, about these women being activated, in many senses, even inspired by the Me Too movement. But there was also some comments about how these women in the Me Too movement, especially the Hollywood women, powerful, have money and so forth, and they weren't saying it out of resentment. I mean, they were certainly applauding what was being moved forward, but at the same time, they felt nobody would hear our voices.
That's right. I mean, we spoke to a number of janitors as we followed up with them in the recent months about what they thought about this, you know, women in Hollywood coming forward, and they did say, it's great that they're stepping forward, but guess what? They have money. They've got all the media attention. They've got all the power. And what about us? Who was there when I spoke up? Nobody. And, you know, I think that's part of why we've seen such an incredible groundswell among these janitors. It's not being talked about as much, but they have found mutual support and aid among each other. They're even learning to do self-defense classes. I mean, use their bodies, take this physical power back, and not just spray an attacker with cleaner like Maria Magana did, but actually, you know, learn how to kick, learn how to poke somebody in the eye. It's been incredible to watch these women who were so timid, so reluctant to tell their stories to us. At first, it took us months of reporting to really build a relationship with them and have them agree to come forward with their stories. And now here they are telling them on the steps of the state capitol, practicing with these big mannequins, you know, jabbing mannequins in the eye, learning how to kick them in all the appropriate places in case they are attacked on the job again.
And being promotoras, you know, spreading the word, organizing. I mean, I'm hoping as a result of all this that the workplace is now safer than it had been. And in fact, let's hear a cut. This is Georgina. I want to go. Bernice, can you set this up for us?
Sure. This is Georgina Hernandez. She's one of the janitors that we met pretty early on in our reporting. And when we first met her, she was just really still feeling the effects of some very extreme sexual harassment, essentially rape on the job when she was cleaning a hotel lobby. And now we met up with her again pretty recently and saw her as she was participating, and not only participating, but leading a self-defense class down in Southern California.
Let's hear.
Oh, mi vida ha sido como es nueva. Yo creo que yo misma no me conozco.
So she had basically just, you know, showed us how to make a fist and punch someone. And she's saying, my life is like new. I almost don't even recognize myself. I'm more confident. I used to see myself in my shadow. But now I'm not afraid of anything. It's really kind of an amazing transformation.
There has been a lot of transformation, not only for these women as individuals, but for what's going on. But there isn't much more in the way of gender equity, more women supervisors, for example, is there?
You're right. I think that the structural changes still leave a lot to be desired. I mean, it's one thing to have new laws in place, as we do, starting this year with a bill that was introduced by Lorena Gonzalez Fletcher here in California that creates a registry so these kind of fly-by-night underground janitorial companies can be kept track of. It also requires more rigorous sexual harassment training, not only for supervisors, but for all janitors. That's one piece of it. The other piece
is... And the registry is established now, right?
It is. It's in
including the some that are off the radar screen.
It's in the process of yeah, there are certain timelines that it'll phase in, but it's taking effect this year and next. But, you know, that's one piece of it is what you can do legislatively. The other piece is what these women are doing, organizing and learning how to protect themselves with their bodies on the job. And I think the third piece is the cultural shift. What can happen in the workplace so that things really change for janitors on the night shift? We've had a number of ideas put forth. They do cost money. I mean, having, for example, people work in pairs so that they're not alone when they're cleaning a building. Having people work during the daytime. Our janitors here at KQED are often cleaning and emptying our waste baskets during the day, not at night when there are other people around.
This is so logical. So it would seem, you know, that they would be put in a place by these big companies, but sometimes you have to poke them in the eye or whatever, you know, using that metaphor that we had with the self-defense training. Let me give the phone number and invite our listeners to join us. In fact, you can do that now with any questions or comments you have about what we're talking about. We're talking about Rape on the Night Shift, which is an investigation into sexual assault against immigrant women janitors. Sasha Coca with us, host of the California Report magazine on KQED, and Bernice Jung, who is reporter for Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting. We do want to hear from you, and let me tell you how you can join the program. Toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. Again, that's toll-free, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org. Or go right to our website and post your questions or comments there at kqed.org/forum and click on this segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. And there are some heroic figures who rise up here, not only many of these women themselves, but Lorena Gonzalez, whom you just mentioned, and David Huerta, who is, of course, the son of Dolores Huerta. Talk about their roles, because you had pretty close contact with them, and those roles are very significant.
I think, you know, one thing that we haven't talked too much about kind of in the larger scale is the role of men. And I think what David Huerta did in the process of kind of compelling the union to move forward with sexual harassment and really addressing it straight on was very significant. Essentially, there was a moment where it was kind of a turning point. The union was renegotiating a contract. The survey that they had issued kind of revealed that a significant number of janitors had experienced sexual harassment and extreme sexual harassment personally. So they really had to take it on. And while they were in a big meeting with hundreds of janitors, they were announcing that this was going to be a priority of theirs. Well, the woman who was making the announcement had to stop short because there was a roar coming from the crowd. It was booing. Booing from the men. And so David Huerta stepped up and he essentially told these men that this was not acceptable, that they were going to stand by their female coworkers, that this was absolutely the right thing to do, and there was not going to be any questions as to whether they were going to take on sexual harassment. And so for the union, that was a really significant turning point. And it was also just a really important moment for men to serve as, you know, to illustrate that it's really important for men to serve as allies and to serve as witnesses and to really step up and say, ya basta, from the male point of view as well.
You mentioned the promotoras, Michael. There is a male equivalent to this that the union has started, which
compadres.
Is compadres, exactly,
claro.
A group of men getting together to talk about this, kind of a men's group. How can we be better witnesses? How can we be better allies? How can we support our coworkers? I mean, David Huerta said to them, these are your mothers, these are your sisters, these are your daughters. You know this is happening. Don't tell me you haven't heard these lewd jokes in the break room or, you know, seen this kind of stuff going on.
Sasha, let me ask you about how this is caught on in other fields, low-income immigrant workers, for example, women workers, farm workers, hotel workers. I mean, this whole movement in general. Can you address that?
Well, you know, it's a little bit ironic because we actually started our investigation with farm workers. Bernice
That's
and
right.
I and the team did a first piece that was called Rape in the Fields, where we were looking at how Farm workers, again, in isolation, sometimes in a walnut orchard or in an isolated packing shed, were being abused by their supervisors. And there were brave women there who spoke up. In fact, the Alianza Nacional, the National Women's Farm Worker Alliance, is the one that sent that letter to the New York Times, to the Me Too movement, saying, hey, we're farm worker women, women of Hollywood. We've got your back. We hear you, but we want to be heard, too. And that has inspired a whole sort of additional movement with the Time's Up Now campaign, women in Hollywood trying to set up a legal fund to support low-wage women workers.
Well, I want to mention that David Huerta is, of course, the president of SEIU West. I'm going to get that in there. I said Dolores Huerta's son. He has other major bona fides that need to be mentioned. And again, we do welcome your involvement in the program. We're talking to Bernice Young and Sasha Coca, and want to hear from you. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. You can also join us by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going to our website, kqed.org/forum. Has there been any connection between, you know, the Hollywood Me Too movement specifically, alliances formed, or sort of a lot of the grassroots movement that we're talking about conjoining?
I think the letter was that Sasha just mentioned was really kind of that first step forward with kind of creating connections between those two groups. And then I think more recently with the Golden Globes, we saw, celebrities bringing labor advocates as guests and wearing black as a sign of solidarity among all female workers. And I think also with the Time's Up Now movement, they've been really, really explicit about trying to incorporate the very many voices of women outside of Hollywood and politics and the media. So there is kind of this effort to now be more inclusive. But I think a lot of the workers still want to know, are they really being heard? That's at least what we've been hearing from the workers we've been covering.
And that sense of solidarity among the workers, I think, can't be overstressed here, because it's really happened. I mean, and the transformation has happened in large part because of the really good work you guys have done. I mean, and those who have been involved in this project from the beginning. I mean, I saw my old friend Lowell Bergman right in the center of this, at least in the initial. And there are a lot of men who are very involved in this.
That's right. I mean, I think one of the things that's been really inspiring for us as journalists is to see that, you know, when our film was screened, again, in Spanish, we had a commitment to doing it bilingually. People would stand up afterwards and tell their stories, essentially say, me too, yo también, in Spanish. That, I think, gave the women who did decide to participate in the project a real sense of validation. That's why they did it. They wanted to get their stories out there so they could empower other people to come forward. And it's sort of been this amazing chain reaction. And again, here they are on the steps of the Capitol during a hunger strike, standing up and telling their stories.
And there's a moment when the announcement is made that Governor Brown has signed the bill being AB 1978, and the response, I mean, is just really...
They sort of fall into this tearful heap.
It's extraordinary. I mean, it's just very poignant and moving because... again, I hesitate to use the word because it's a word that's become fraught in many ways, but solidarity was there. You know, you couldn't mistake it. Speaking of solidarity, let's solidly bring some callers onto this. And we begin with Maria. Maria, join us.
Hi there. Thank you for having me. I appreciate the light that you're shedding on this issue. And in addition to that, I'd like to know what's being done for teachers. I myself have been a teacher with the San Francisco Unified School District, and on several occasions have had to deal with male teachers who have displayed inappropriate behavior, and there's not much being done for it. And additionally, through legislation and government, I have been a victim of sexual abuse and tried to press charges and was told by the DA that there was not enough evidence to go further. And I want to know how to bridge that gap between people wanting to share their stories and not being totally protected when they come out and say these things.
Thank you for the question. Important question. Bernice, you're on.
Thank you, Maria, and thank you for sharing your experience with us. I'm sorry that you had to go through all of that. I think, well, there's two questions there, and I think the first one is for a lot of these workers who didn't have a lot of support initially. The union has now become a pretty significant support. So they have started to take on these issues, and they have started to seek out ways to prevent and do training and to really just take the issue on. And so I'm wondering, could the teachers union take a more proactive role in all of this? And then when it comes to kind of the criminal prosecution piece, that is a really, really challenging aspect of this whole problem. And it's something that I've been doing some additional reporting on, and it's actually something that I spend some time looking at in my book project. And it's unfortunately often very frustrating and dissatisfying for a lot of victims, because the criminal justice system is not really set up to really provide, I think, the kind of justice that a lot of people are seeking. It is a lot about protecting the, as is necessary, the liberty of those who are accused.
There are about 17,000, by the Justice Department's estimate, reported sexual assaults each year. How many of these actually go through the process of adjudication and justice?
Single digits.
Yeah,
so I mean, it's tiny. And I think one of the biggest concerns is that prosecutors sometimes are concerned about how a jury will respond to the allegations. And there are just so many myths out there about sexual assault and rape that, you know, even when the prosecutor believes the victim, even when there is some modicum of evidence, even when the victim's testimony is evidence, sometimes prosecutors just don't choose to move forward, and I think we should be asking why.
And we know that reported number is way, way lower than the actual number of assaults.
I mean, the actual number of unreported far exceeds that. What is also, speaking about men in all this, Maria Magana, I'm sorry.
Magana,
thank you. Her husband, and, you know, it comes from a macho culture. He's Mexican-American. And the fact that his wife was not only raped and assaulted, but that this was being done by a man who was a friend of his.
Oh, you know, yeah, I think that's a different case. That's the one of the cases in Minnesota. But you're right. There is a story like that.
I'm sorry. Confusing the case. Yeah. But the torment that he was going through, and even you could see it in his son's eyes, too, you know, as men feeling, you know, they have to stand up and do something about this just in terms of the code that they live by.
And I think it's really important to realize that, yes, the most immediate harm and violence happens to women, but really the violence and harm, you know, is broadcast across communities and families. I mean, the impact on the son and the father when we met with them was just harrowing. And
so there was the case that couldn't go forward because they didn't have the evidence.
That's right. No, and, you know, for many of these women, choosing to participate and tell their stories on film or on radio was also sort of a coming out to their family. They hadn't told their partners in many cases or their children. And, you know, the impact is very, very deep. There was a case here of a woman who was raped at the San Francisco Ferry Building. And, you know, her son has gone on to kind of do work in this area, to actually go out and, you know, talk about these kinds of dynamics and work in the social work arena, because he's been so, it was so incredibly transformative to him to be a teenager and to watch his mother go going through this, you know, locking herself up in her room and crying and not telling the family what was going on.
I'll bring another caller aboard here, and let me go next to you. Swathi, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm calling from Burlingame. This Me Too movement has started me worrying about individuals with special needs. I have a child with autism. And she goes to the day program. She takes the transportation provided by the day program. And I keep worrying about how about the individuals that cannot, you know, cannot speak. They cannot say if something should happen, you know, when they go in the to their programs. It keeps worrying me a lot. I don't know what to do about it, but I thought that I would say, and the Me Too movement is a very good thing. I think we are kind of thinking about what's happening behind our eyes. But about special needs individuals is something I'm a little concerned about because I have a daughter.
Well, thank you. Thank you. And I appreciate your call. And let me just go on to another caller here, and that's Laura. Laura, join us.
Hi, am I on the air?
Yes, you are.
Hi, I'm an attorney, and I just wanted to mention, because you were talking about how there's limitations on what the criminal system can do to address sexual assault, and I wanted to raise that there is a possibility of civil actions for causes of action like personal injury, for domestic violence, sexual assault, even human trafficking. And that is a way where there's a lower burden of proof. And so there is much more likelihood of success and recovery in some form of a court pointing out that there has been a wrong done for the victim.
Yeah, important point, and thank you for that, Laura. Appreciate hearing from you. And in fact, talking about actions that can be taken, here's Joan who writes, for any company that has successfully sued for failure to protect its workers, why not protest in front of its clients? Those companies won't want the publicity and will drop the offending companies. Reasonably good suggestion. Here's a tweet from Arturo. He's from Mexico, and he says, do you know if there is some action from the consulate to protect Mexican immigrant workers? Bernice?
I do believe that the consulate has been pretty active on this issue. They've had seminars and trainings at various locations, and they have definitely taken this on as something that they're paying attention to.
They've certainly held screenings of our film projects, too, for their communities.
Well, since you mentioned the screening, let me advise our listeners that the Frontline documentary Rape on the Night Shift will air tonight at 7 p.m. on KQED-TV and other PBS stations. And the California Report magazine story will air this Friday, and a story on the investigation will be on the podcast and radio show Reveal this weekend. So we've got all that covered, I think. And what are you going to cover from this point forward in this whole realm that we're talking about? I mean, you've opened up lots here.
Well, I think for me, as the initial caller raised, this question around criminal prosecutions is something that I'm spending probably much of 2018 looking into. Kind of what are the barriers? Why are the systems set up the way that they are? What is justice? And who can the criminal justice system provide the kind of justice that a lot of victims are seeking? So those are some of the questions I'm asking myself at this moment.
Asking similar questions, Sasha, or a different question?
You know, I think what's really important to look at are these structural changes, whether it's the janitorial industry, the farm workers. We are seeing these bits and pieces of legislation filter through. Are they going to make a change? Is it enough to just have more sexual harassment training? How do you make sure that that training actually has teeth and is not just perfunctory?
And excuse me, that training is for both supervisors as well as the workers.
That's right. But in the past, we've seen that they've been trained and they just sign a paper and say, yeah, I get it. You know, you're not supposed to say certain things to women.
Well, again, congratulations for the work you've done, and onward and upward. We will continue to monitor this, and you can actually, again, see the documentary we've been talking about this evening on Channel 9 here. And we've been talking about Rape on the Night Shift. It's an investigation, again, into sexual assault against immigrant women janitors with KQED Sasha Coca and Bernice Jung, reporter for Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and author of the forthcoming book, let's give that a plug too, and a day's work, The Fight to End Sexual Violence Against America's Most Vulnerable Workers. They reported the story as part of a collaboration between KQED, Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting, Frontline, Univision, and the Investigative Reporting Program at UC Berkeley. When we return, we're going to talk to a great linguist.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by Jan Schramm and Maria Minetti Schramm, founders of the Minetti Schramm Museum of Art at UC Davis, which preserves the legacy of renowned artists such as Wayne Thiebaud for future innovators by dedicating a third of its space to arts education.